An open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to connect to contact an anonymous organization that more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Corey Klostermeyer, and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous.
A manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought.
Is two 10-minute speakers, followed by a main speaker. Speakers, please note that you will be given a 5-minute and a 1-minute reminder when it's time to wrap up your talk. Our first 10-minute speaker is Jonathan Kay.
Jonathan, alcoholic. So I just realized today that the last time I spoke in front of this many people, it's when I won an essay contest in middle school for Just Say No about why I was drug-free. So we see how well that worked out now. But yeah, I'd like to thank you, Marty, for asking me to share tonight. The first time I came to this meeting, I was wearing sandals and shorts and a t-shirt, and I went up to an old timer to shake his hand in the line, and he just asked me if I just came from the beach. So I think I've come a little bit of a way in the last year or so. Growing up, I had a pretty good, my parents were supportive and everything. But, I think like a lot of alcoholics talk about when I hear them share, just that feeling of, being out of place. I was really overweight growing up and picked on a lot. And so the first time someone asked me to drink or to use drugs or whatever, I was more than happy to say yes and participate. Actually, the first time it didn't really work out because I got sold a bag of oregano. But, the second time from then on, I was. And I was in middle school when, I first started drinking and kind of going through middle school and high school. I did pretty well in school but I got in trouble a lot. And I was just, like I said, just feeling, I was constantly looking for attention and, whether it was good or bad, it didn't matter to me. I was, just getting in trouble a lot. Then, kind of the group that I started to associate with were people that, also like to drink and like to use. And, when I finally did, that was just, kind of the first time that I felt normal. And, I didn't really know what was wrong with me growing up or why, things felt so wrong. But, once I drank, I knew that was a feeling that I liked and that I wanted to stick with. And, so I got in trouble a lot through high school and, had my first, I think it was, my sophomore year of high school, my first DUI, and also, got arrested for like a curfew violation. And this is a small town in Indiana that I grew up in, and also stealing one of those big orange traffic construction cones, just being stupid with some of my friends. And that was the first time I guess you could say I got sober, was when I was on probation for about 6 months. And in as I went through that, things I had kind of like lost my interest in school and everything like that. But, as I was sober for those 6 months, like I got back to doing well. And then, what I realized is, as soon as that time was over and, I kind of checked the box off and was done with that, then, it was pretty immediately that I went back to doing the same thing with my friends and started drinking again. And, where it really took off though, like through the rest of high school I did, but when I finally moved away for college when I was 18, finally moving out of my house and out of a small town into, a big college party town in Bloomington, Indiana, at Indiana University, things really took off from there. And I was using a lot and drinking a lot. I try not to talk too much about it, but drugs are a part of my story as well, along with alcohol, and, both were kind of combined. But, the thing was with my drinking is I could never just be one of those people that, and I think from, really a young age is, I couldn't really be one of those people that, would just have a drink or two with anybody. It was like, if that's what we decided we were going to do, I'd be taking, shot after shot until I was sick. And I just couldn't control it from early on. And, the first time when I finally, I think, Yeah, it was my second year of college that, you know, I ran into some more legal trouble. I got arrested a couple of times. And finally, my parents asked me if, you know, they knew that I had a problem, and I was trying to deny it. But they asked me if I wanted to get help. And, you know, I said yes, but it was that time that I was more pushed into, you know, getting it, and not so much for myself. And, you know, I stayed sober for about 90 days after treatment. And then I went back to, I went back to it, and I didn't stay sober for much longer after that. And then, I had gotten to a place in 2010, when, you know, I was doing well in college, but, you know, I was more worried about using, and I got to the point where I dropped all of my classes and what wasn't even going. And, I just remember one day waking up and just being tired of who I was, and, you know, tired of going through all the legal troubles. And, you know, after relapsing, it got as bad as it was before, and even worse. So, you know, I asked my dad to take me into treatment again, and I got sober another time. But that time, you know, I started to actually get a sponsor and do the steps. And that was in 2010. And, you know, I stayed sober for a long time. And, you know, I worked the program for a while, but, you know, I just really fell away from it and got very complacent. And, yeah, and I would say for like 3 or 4 years I did, was still going to meetings, but at some point I stopped and just told myself I didn't need them anymore. And told myself that, you know, everything was going well without, you know, working the steps or doing anything. And so, you know, in 2017, finally, I was sober for about 7 years, and I moved out here from Indiana to start law school at USC. And after my first year, you know, I did really well, and I immediately had jumped into a relationship when I got out here. We were living together, and after my first year and doing well, you know, I told myself, you know, maybe I'm not actually an alcoholic, and you know, maybe, yeah, I was just young and dumb, and, you know, got in some trouble, and I should, you know, it'd be safe for me to just have a drink again. And, you know, before I knew it, you know, I was back, and it had been almost 8 years, and I was back to drinking like I had been before within a few days, and drinking and using. And, you know, I realized that, like, when I stopped working on myself, it's just, you know, nothing really changed if, you know, I wasn't making any progress. And so, yeah, it was after relapsing, you know, I continued, I, you know, stayed in school out here, but I, you know, luckily didn't, you know, make the choice to, like, drop out or anything like that. But I did drink pretty solidly a lot for the last year and a half, and, you know, really ran that relationship into the ground. And, I didn't get into any more legal trouble, but, you know, my life was just a mess, and I was pretty miserable. And, you know, from the outside, and I was just talking to my sponsor about this during our book study, this week, you know, from the outside, it looked pretty good. I had, you know, just accepted a job for after I graduate, and things seemed to be going pretty well, but I was just miserable. And I realized that, you know, drinking wasn't doing it anymore and wasn't helping me. I went, you know, to actually psychiatrist just to look for a solution that way. And she told me I needed to take care of my substance abuse issue. And that's the night I, you know, decided to go to my first AA meeting again. And actually my second one was the Pacific Group meeting, the Key Group. And I heard Eddie speak and share, and, you know, asked him to be my sponsor afterwards. And, you know, I just tried to jump right into PG, and, you know, I realized I went a little long on my background for 10 minutes here, but, yeah, so I've just, you know, for the last year, I just celebrated a year on Friday, and, you know, just trying to do the, you know, different, do things differently, the sobriety, and, you know, work thing, you know, or really focus on what the steps are about. And, you know, just try to remember each day that, you know, I am an alcoholic, and it, yeah, it wasn't just me being young. And yeah, that's really all I have to share. Thank you.
Thank you. Our second 10-minute speaker is Linda W.
Hi, I'm an alcoholic and my name is Linda. And I'd like to thank Marty for asking me to share tonight. It's a privilege to speak in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wanted to say that I belong to the best two home groups in the world. The Pacific Group is one, Aloha Spirit in Canada is the other. And my sponsor is Sharon C. I'm a sponsor and I sponsor sponsors. And to let you know a little bit about, you know, what the deal was for me is I grew up in Calgary, Alberta. And if you know Calgary, you'll know why I drank. There's nothing else to do. And I grew up in, you know, I always say in a normal alcoholic home because I didn't know any different. But my dad was nicknamed Stormin' Norman, and he was a violent alcoholic. And I was the youngest girl with three older brothers. And we grew up, you know, with crazy, crazy household, you know. And the reason I mention it is because my brother was a heroin addict, and he ended up getting sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then very shortly after he got sober, my dad got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And our house changed. Our house changed. I watched AA come into our house. And I always say, you know, the first time my dad came in carrying groceries, it was like, what? And then he says to my mom, oh, can I vacuum? It's like, vacuum? My father doesn't vacuum, right? And so, like, it was a big deal in our house because it changed immensely, you know? And I always say I just went out thinking that I was not going to drink because I didn't want to be like my dad. And I loved my brothers, and I always hung out with my brothers, and I, you know, I admired them. And we, you know, because we saw such horrific things in our home, you know, I thought we would never drink. And so one night I go, and my brother, I come home from being with my friends, and my brother has got a full on, because my parents were out of town, party going on. And I go to find him, and he's drinking and passed out. So I have to take over taking care of the house while my parents are out. And anyways, that changed my life because I started drinking then. And when I started drinking, I have always had what I call a God-sized hole. And I tried sports, I tried school, I tried everything. And once I tried alcohol, I was like, oh yeah, this is good. This works, right? And I'm just the type of alcoholic, when I drink, I turn into a drug addict. And I just want more and more of everything and all of it. And I pretty much was a teenage crazy kid, like drugs, sex, rock and roll. Like, my life was out of control. And I always say, when I was 16 years old, in Alberta, you can get your driver's license at 14. And by 16, I was driving, like, instant. My parents bought me a car and I was off, right? And we would drink and drive back then. Like, Calgary was kind of a small hick town at the time, and country living, and we were like insane. And I'm driving home one night, I got the bottle and we're drinking, I'm with a girlfriend, and I go around the corner and I smash, sideswipe the car, stop, freak out, jump out of the car, throw the booze away, and drive away from the scene. And then lie to my mom about it, you know? And that was a pattern that continued. Like, alcohol and drugs and party and lifestyle, it was insane. And what happened for me is I went to university and I started teaching an aerobic class. And what happened is I got through about a year and a half into university. I'm thinking, you know, I kind of like doing aerobics better. And I'm a half measures never avail me nothing. So I start teaching two classes. Then I start teaching three classes. Then I'm teaching four. Then I'm teaching five aerobic classes a day, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And I think it would be a good idea to work in the bar, you know, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. So I start working in a nightclub. So I'm teaching these aerobics. I'm working in a nightclub. And then I get asked by the TV station if I want to come on and be one of those aerobic TV girls. So now I'm a TV star, right? I'm drinking, I'm partying, I'm living the life. I'm living life in the fast lane. And basically, if you're living the life that I'm living, like, things are just getting worse. And I'm starting to sell my soul. and things I'm doing more. And I can't, you know, I feel like I have values and morals and I can't keep them. I can't, you know, I'm just, and it's like pretty soon the party is from, you know, Friday to Sunday, then it's Thursday to Monday, and then it's Tuesday to Wednesday, you know, like the week. And I'm trying to keep up with this lifestyle, and I keep doing things and I keep making money. So I keep getting credit cards, and then the credit card, then I'm paying this credit card to pay that credit card. Cause if you're a good alcoholic like me, the more money you have, the more you spend. It's just like, there was nothing, everything in my life was unmanageable. I couldn't pay my rent. Like things were just spiraling out of control. And yet I had like a brand new car. Like I had money, like I had all this stuff and I'm drinking. So fast forward, zoom me to Vancouver because Calgary's the problem. And what happened when I got to Vancouver was within a year of being in Vancouver, which I didn't even see Vancouver, this beautiful ocean cities, all that. None of it. I hit bottom in Vancouver and I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And the gift that happened for me in Alcoholics Anonymous is that at that first meeting, my brother dropped me off and he said two things. You need to be clean and sober and you need to give it away to keep it. And he literally dropped me at the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And these two giants pulled me in sober a long time, all smiley and happy. And they want me to, you know, stay here. And the thing is, I couldn't quite get it. So I was talking to this drug and alcohol counselor and she said, well, why don't you go to rehab for 30 days? So basically that's what happened. I went to rehab for 30 days. And what happened in rehab was I quit everything, drugs, smoking, drinking, and I was kind of going crazy. So that basically what happened was I got to teach aerobics to my group there. And I'm looking out at them all thinking, oh my God, I'm going to teach aerobics to these losers. And that was the turning point, folks, because as soon as I said that, I went, you're one too. That's why you're here. You're an alcoholic. And that, and then for the next 30 days, I did what you said. And basically what happened is when I got out of there, my friends all wanted to have a party for me. So they pick me up, they light up a spliff, they're smoking cigarettes. And like, I rolled the window down telling them that I was at this health farm, that I quit that stuff. And we get to the restaurant and they all order wine and they want to celebrate me. So this is what happens. 30 days, glass of wine. 30 days, glass of wine. I think, the 30 days, right? I go to drink the wine. My friend comes in, sits down, grabs the glass, drinks it up, slams it on the table and goes, drank your wine. And I'm thinking, was that God? That's what I'm thinking. And then I go, nah, why don't you order Sambuca? So I order Sambuca to the table. And next thing I know, the waitress comes over with the drink and she goes, is there a Linda at the table? I go, that's me. She goes, you have a phone call. I go get the phone call and it's my boyfriend. He has a flat tire. He wants me to come right away. And I walked out of the restaurant and I knew right then that God had done for me what I could not do for myself. October 13th, 1985. And I never believed that I would stay sober. Never. Why? Alcoholics Anonymous, Lamesville. I was too young. It didn't seem like the thing. But when that happened for me, I knew that I needed to do what you suggested. And that was get a home group, join that home group, get a sponsor, be of service in that home group, get active, go to, you know, do the big book, read the book, all this stuff. And the thing that happened for me in the big book, when I read step one and it said that I was bodily and mentally different than my fellows, I knew I was home. And I also knew I was home because they were definitely spaceship people. As my sponsor says, I thought, my people, they're all, there's like Planet Claire. I think I'm there. And the bottom line was, I started to get active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was lucky enough to meet a guy in my second year of sobriety that happened to be a member of the Pacific Group. And he was a pilot. And so that just brought me into the world of Alcoholics Anonymous. He brought me down to the Pacific Group. I got to meet Clancy and Sharon and all these great people. And we would go anywhere. Like, talk about going to any lengths to stay sober. You guys drove anywhere to go to a meeting. Hour and a half here, hour and a half there. Like, the service was, and you had the yard and you had volleyball and you had baseball. And I wanted this in Canada. So when I would go come back home and I would be at home, I started volleyball on Friday nights. I started the baseball team, the A&A baseball team. And we just had, you know what? It just rocketed me into the fourth dimension of the world of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I filled my car with women and I went everywhere. I went roundups here. I went with John too. He would take me. We would go here, all the greats everywhere. And like Clancy, wherever Clancy was speaking, we would go. And I'm just going to finish with this, that, having Sharon has been a huge influence in my sobriety. The Giants of Alcoholics Anonymous has been a huge influence in my life. And the thing about Sharon is our lives are so parallel. So many things about Sharon, even the Beacon truck, they have them in Canada. And whenever I would see one, I would think, I would always see one when I was completely stressed. Beacon of light. It's like, right. And the thing is, Sharon officially became my sponsor at Christmas time. And this year before the pandemic, and it's the greatest gift that happened to me, because I went to her retreat, met all my sisters, and basically we got locked down, and I've been traveling the world with all my sobriety sisters all over the world. And it's been a gift, and our reach is deep here. So I'm just going to leave you with contrary action. Be inconvenienced, you know, reach out, get phone numbers, be of service. It's an action program, and it's based upon your spiritual maintenance, and maintenance means work. So it takes work, you know, like if someone asks you to do something and you don't want to do it, right? Like this deal is for the people, and I'll finish with this, is not for people who want it. It's not for people who need it. It's for people who do it. So thank you for letting me participate in my sobriety. This is for you, Sharon.
AA. Thank you. Our main speaker tonight is Sybil D.
Hi, everybody. My name is Sybil Davis, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really happy to be here tonight. I want to thank Marty for asking me to share. And I want to thank everybody earlier before the meeting for making me feel so welcome and so comfortable. And Corey, it was nice to connect with you and some of our Midwestern roots. My sobriety date is September 2nd of 1989. I was able to just celebrate 31 years of sobriety, and I just can't hardly believe it. And yet on the other hand, when I think about it, I really can, because I know AA really works. I saw in the chat box that there's a number of people here that are maybe just starting out. And I'm really happy to see you here, and I hope that you come back, and I hope that I keep coming back. Perhaps tonight when I share my story with you, you hear something that resonates, and maybe you won't. And if you don't, go to another meeting, and hopefully you'll hear somebody that you can connect with. I want to thank Jonathan and Linda as well for sharing their experience tonight. I really enjoyed getting to know you better. I'm calling in tonight from Harrisonburg, Virginia, which is about an hour west of Charlottesville. And I'm really happy to be with you tonight. Before the meeting, I saw a number of people on here that I know from early years in sobriety, like Phil C and early sponsor Kathy M. And, you know, my current sponsor, Steve, is here tonight. There's been other people in this group that have worked with me, like Diana out in New York, and I've gotten to visit your group a few times in person. And I've always felt really welcome there. And that's a special thing, to come into a room of people and different people. Maybe you don't know so many people, and it's a good place to be. So I want to thank you for that. People mentioned Sharon, and Sharon's been a longtime friend of mine. I mean, she's really like family to me. And of course, Cindy Coleman is one of my best friends in the world. And, I've met some new friends on Zoom during the pandemic, Liz, and reconnected with Heather, some different people. And it's just nice to spend the night with you here tonight. So at any rate, I could relate to Linda quite a bit. You know, I grew up in a family in Bettendorf, Iowa. I'm the youngest of three. I got two older brothers. And there was one thing that, looking back, I was just recently back there, and I was looking at some really old pictures, and I found some pictures of me at a bunch of different neighbors' house when I was really, really little. And my mom at that time, she called me the friend maker, you know, because what I would do is we lived in a neighborhood where I could just go out, and then I'd go from house to house to house, and I'd go visiting, and I just enjoyed it. You know, I'd help wash cars, I'd do that. And I was little, you know, I wasn't grown by any means. And that was just kind of what I did naturally, you know, and really enjoyed that. And somewhere along the line, I can tell you that through Alcoholics Anonymous, I've kind of gotten back to that. But I want to tell you a little more about what happened, I guess, in the middle. So as we continued on, and we moved from Des Moines to Bettendorf, there's a lot of drinking that went on in our household. And there was drinking to the point where one thing that I knew for sure that I was never going to do was drink alcohol. I just wasn't going to do it. It was a certainty. I didn't know, I didn't have like a lot of determination about very many things, but that was one of them, because it was a scary thing. You know, I saw the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde situation happening on a very regular nightly basis in our home, and, you know, frightened me. And I can remember, you know, running away from that dinner table as quick as I can and running up those stairs and hanging over the balcony and leaning down and listening. And when is the challenging stuff downstairs going to be over? And just wearing myself out and then going to bed. And, you know, I wasn't comfortable. And I wasn't a person that had the skills at any point to go into my room and sit to myself and think, you know, Sybil, you're going to be okay. And you just stick to your own, what you want to do, and you're going to be all right. That wasn't me. You know, when I look at myself and I would think about how things were going to go, I think, you know, I'm not going to be okay. And there's something wrong with me. And I don't want to tell anybody about this. And who am I going to talk to? And I lived in fear is what happened for me there. And what I did is I started to settle pretty quickly. And what I mean by that is, I started to settle for this idea that as long as you couldn't figure out that I don't feel like I'm enough, or that I don't have what it takes to make it like you seem to have, as long as I can put a cover over that, pull the wool over your eyes, or however you want to look at it, then that's enough for me. And the way that I went about with that was I would get to know you, and I would think about what you like and what you want, and then I would pretend like I like that too. And then maybe I wasn't really making a connection with anybody, but at least you weren't noticing how bad I felt about myself. You wouldn't laugh at me. That was one of the things I just didn't want to be laughed at. I didn't want to be noticed for being so different. And look, I'm in Bettendorf, Iowa. I'm going up the hill. I'm going to the school bus just like everybody else. I'm joining the teams. I'm doing the things just like everybody else. The only thing that mattered there, though, was in my mind, I wasn't like you, you know, and one thing was for sure, you weren't going to get to know that. And I did, you know, so I was lying from way back out of the gate, long before I started drinking. And one of the other kind of neat things for me is I feel like I was a recipient of one of the longest 12-step calls. And if you're new, a 12-step call is kind of like when people in AA that have had an experience and they have some sobriety, and they want to go out and help somebody else that maybe hasn't tried this way of life before, and they're drinking a lot and they want to stop and they don't know what to do. And they'll go and they'll share their story. And that's a 12-step call in short. And I had this family up the hill from us, and I was friends with their daughter, Beth. We're the same age. We've been friends since we were 5 years old. And I would go up there about three times a week, and I would just unwind. And I'd sit around the dinner table and I'd just giggle and I'd just be releasing all this stuff that I was holding on to. And then I go back home and I go back in, get in my bed and hope for the best, you know, to get a night's sleep and then hope for the best the next day and continue on the way I was doing. And then, you know, what it turned out for there is that those people up the hill were members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so even when I was a little kid, 5 years old, all the way up through when I started drinking, they welcomed me. And I can remember Beth's mom, I mean, when at one point for Christmas time, she invited me up there and she showed me all of my friends' Christmas presents. I don't know if you remember the Stretch Armstrong, but I remember clear as day, we're up in their closet. She said, "Don't you tell Tommy that this is his special Christmas present. And I'm just showing you because I thought you'd think that was kind of neat to know, but I'm going to trust you not to tell." And I thought that was the best thing that had happened to me, you know? And I kept that secret. I mean, that was important stuff, you know, and somebody taking a chance on me. Because at the same time, there's always that little spark, you know, that maybe I'm all right, you know, maybe I'm decent. And of course, then the fear would win out again and I'd start covering up. So at the time when I started drinking, I was a summer before high school. It was much like Linder's experience. My parents were out of town. My brother was older. He was having a giant party. I had friends with Beth to go up to her house, you know, and spend some time, watch a movie or whatever, because she didn't drink or anything like that. And I was taking care of the neighbor's house and or their plants and such while they were out of town. And I decided to have a wine cooler. And, you know, I was adamant, as I said, that I was never going to drink, but something just took over. And I was the summer before I was going to high school, and I was going through all my hormones, and I was, you know, all of my friends were starting to like boys and I wasn't, and there was something wrong with me there too now. And what am I going to do about that? And I decided to have a drink that night, and I didn't necessarily feel anything different right away, but what that did was it enabled me to have the courage to walk into my parents' house where this party was going on. And I wanted a new experience. And so I dumped Beth that night, and I went in, and my brother's friend, Kelly, who's one of the football players, and he shared his wine coolers with me that night. And I got really drunk that night, and I had like such a good time. You know, all the bedrooms in my parents' house, they were full of all these teenagers that were doing things that I was a late bloomer, and I had no idea what they were doing in all those bedrooms, but I didn't care. And I was going in those rooms and saying hi and what's happening. And I'm sure I made a fool out of myself, and I couldn't wait to do it again, you know? And so I went, you know, in the big book, it talks in the back of the book, in one of the appendices, about spiritual experience, you know, and a spiritual experience being this idea that, you know, ideas and emotions and attitudes and such that once drove us or pushed aside, and now we're driven by something different in terms of spirituality. And I can tell you that alcohol, you know, I did have a spiritual experience with alcohol too, because that person that the night before I ever drank was adamant I was never going to drink again, all of a sudden that is all I wanted to do. And so I my life changed dramatically from that point. And so I made my friends by who drank like me. I stole from people so that I could, and I always acted badly from right out of the gate. And what I would do is I would steal, and then I would go out with my friends, and I would basically pay them off to all right, I'll buy all the alcohol. We'll get somebody to buy this alcohol for us because we're kids. And what's going to happen here is I'm going to pay for it, and then you're going to make sure I get home and also not give me a hard time about if I act out badly. And I thought it was a good deal, you know. So, but I was already kind of managing these different types of behaviors that I had. And so I was out of control from right out of the gate. And I drank as much as I could, as often as I could. I mean, I was a child. I binge drank, you know. And I can always relate now to people that were like, you know, I could relate in the back of the book, like people talking about hiding their alcohol and, you know, different meetings I've been to where people talk about hiding from their spouse, and, you know, all of a sudden they got sober and the whole garage ceiling is full of all these bottles, and it's like, oh, you know. And I was like that. I was sneaky. And by the time I hit 18, I had a lot of, you know, things. It wasn't funny anymore. People weren't saying, hey, Sib, you know what you did last night? People were saying, you know, why'd you have to act that way? And so my idea on that was like, I'm going to leave and go have a new experience. And so I went down to Arizona, and I thought I could stop drinking and just make that decision. And now I'm going to do something different. And my parents paid for me to go down to college down there. And my mom's a very good seamstress. She actually makes pretty much all of her nice clothing. And she made me some dresses. You know, she took my measurements and, you know, a perfect fit and everything like that. But I can tell you, they paid for me to go through Sorority Rush. And if you're not familiar with that, the idea behind that is that you're going to go to these parties and you're going to try to connect with other young women, and you go to this big school and maybe you make a connection and you're not feel so lonely, and you'll have a better experience on campus. And it's a great idea, except I stopped drinking then, and I was going to these parties. And if you're the kind of person that wears, you know, sweats and a t-shirt all the time and drinks a lot, and then you stop drinking and then you put on a dress, I mean, at least for me, I don't care like how nice the dress looks on a hanger, maybe on somebody else. I just felt so awkward, and I felt like everybody could see that, and I had zero defense. I had zero solution. And I can remember being at one of these parties, and I realized at that time I could no longer really have a conversation with anybody. And I had a new solution come over me that night, and I was sitting at the hearth of this fireplace, and there was all these young women talking to each other and having fun. And I sat there and I thought, you know what? This is fine. I'm going to sit here tonight and I'm going to let time pass and I'm not going to say anything to anybody anymore. And at some point, if I keep breathing, I'm not going to be here anymore. And that's fine with me. And that was my new coping skill. And I made it through that night. And as quick as I could, I found some other people that drank like me. I started drinking again. And I found other people who did a lot of drugs the way that I drank. And in short order, in about a year from that point, I had experienced a lot of, you know, really challenging things, a lot of uncomfortable, painful things that took a lot of years to unwind and talk about. And ultimately, I found you about a year later. And I got sober when I was 19 years old. My first meetings were in Ames, Iowa, actually. And some people are here tonight are in Ames. And there was a lady by the name of Jill C. And I don't think she remembers this, but I called up AA and I ended up in her house and she was reading the big book with me. And I didn't stay sober from that point in time, but I was on my way. And I ended up going back to Arizona and I went to my first meetings there. And gosh, I made a lot of mistakes there. In about 2 weeks' time, I met somebody that had about 14 months. And, you know, that was the first person I had an honest laugh with, it seemed, and I was all in. You know, and I just had a lot of wrong ideas about things. I had no idea who I was. I had no idea what I was about, but I was pretty sure I was still not going to make it. At the same time, there was something here. My friend Beth's parents, they sent me my first big book, and they indicated in that book, "Dear Sybil, we hope that this book brings you as much hope and happiness that it has brought to us, and we're here for you." And that meant something to me. It's no different than seeing those toys back there all those years ago in Christmas time. And here's somebody believing in me and thinking that maybe I have something worthwhile. And I'll tell you, I made a lot of mistakes because I was still running in a lot of fear. And when, if you're like me and you're running on fear, you're going to do things based on what's the least scary. And that's really no good way to live. That's not a good way to have any kind of consistent outcome. But the problem with that was I didn't have anything different to do. And so I had stopped drinking and I was terrified about that. I wasn't really sure if that was going to go, because what I was thinking about with sobriety was what I felt like before I started drinking. And that was no good at all. And so, but I gave it a shot because I was more afraid of the consequences that were happening when I was drinking. So anyway, I went back to, I bounced around a bunch and I ended up back in Ames, Iowa. And I'm so happy that I did, because at that time there was a bunch of people that there's a couple people like Phil and different things that were being sponsored out of Bellevue, Nebraska. And it was really an enthusiastic type of sobriety with, you know, getting into routines, making commitments and such, showing up for a home group early, doing service there, stuff like that. And those are all really foreign concepts to me. And it wasn't because I didn't want to come and participate with that. It was because part of me understood that if I just participated in kind, at some point, somebody's going to sit down and try to have an honest conversation with me about who I am and what I am. And I just wasn't ready for that. It just took some time. And I continued to break open. And about 3 years sober, I met Kathy M., who's here on the meeting tonight. She became my sponsor, and she said to me, she said, "Sybil," she said, "you know what, why don't you just start with the truth and go from there?" And at that point in time, I was about ready to have an affair with my previous sponsor's husband. I wasn't able to talk with anybody about that, and I just knew I had to leave again. And so my plan was to go to Minneapolis and start drinking again. And I had some friends over for dinner that night from the program. And Sonia was one of them that Corey knows, and another woman. And they left and they said, "You know what, Sybil, there's clearly something really wrong with you. And if you can't talk to us, maybe you can talk with my sponsor," and gave me Kathy's number. And I'm so grateful that I called her. And she said, "Yeah, sure, come on over." And as I said, you know, she became my sponsor. And she said to me, "We're going to go through the book together, you and I." And she said, "We're going to do what it says in here. And if at any point in time I give you a suggestion that seems off from what this book is telling you to do or what the experience here says, please please let me know, because I've just been doing this a little bit longer than you, and I'd probably go with a book, don't go with me. And I thought that was really an interesting way to put it. And, you know, I used to go over to Kathy's house, and that I just started making my beginning just to be able to talk a little bit about myself and take me going over there after the meeting, and we'd chat. And she was a night owl, thank goodness. And I'd literally go underneath a blanket about 2 a.m. I'd finally start saying a little bit of what was going on with me, really. You know, and I hope that if you're new here, or if you're bottled up and you're jammed up and you're not talking about whatever it is, that you go find your person, you keep with it, you go, you take your flashlight under your blanket and you do what it takes, and you let a little bit of that out and you find a safe place. And, you know, sometimes in AA, I've found a safe place and sometimes I haven't. But I tell you, when there's, you know, because there's people like me in here, there's people that are running on fear in here, and sometimes it doesn't work out like I hope. You know, but there's always somebody there that has that longer experience. And it was through Kathy that I first met Sharon out of this group. And Sharon, I remember we connected. She'd come back to visit in Iowa sometimes. And when I started talking a little bit, I actually started having fun in AA. I started being able to participate and stuff like that and show up for commitments more and actually be where I said I was going to be when I was going to be there. And that was different. And it was kind of shocking in our community, like, what's going on with Sybil? You know, she's actually showing up where she says, and, you know, but it was happening for me. And I remember Sharon said to me once, she's like, Sybil, I don't know what it is about you, but you bring out every single one of my character defects at the very same time, and I think I like you. And I was like, yes. And we've continued our friendship through the years. And as I said, she's like family to me, and it's taught me a great deal about being part of a family. In fact, in short order after that point, you know, before I was reconciled with my parents and my family, I had moved around a bit more after I graduated college, and her whole family basically took me in. And it just, one thing led to another. And, you know, they'd have me over for Christmas, they'd have me for birthdays and things like that. And it was something beyond what I could ever repay. And I thank you for that. And you're in there, her brother and sister-in-law, and of course her mother, and met her dad and so on. And a lot of fireworks together in the 4th of July, and just so many great connections. And I would have missed it. If I would have gone up to Minneapolis that night, I would have missed it if I would have bought in and exclusively to what I thought about how things are going to go. And I'm so grateful to God and to, you know, people like Sharon and people like Kathy and Phil and, you know, Ashley, different people, Steve, that see something in me beyond what I can recognize in myself at certain times. And that's still true today. I really do believe that at certain times my perspective is wrong. And that's why it's so neat that Bill Wilson, Dr. Bob got together and started talking and started having a new experience together as two, rather than either one of them could have as individuals. And I try to put myself each day and with other alcoholics to have a similar experience like that, something beyond just what I think about how things are going to go or what I want, and actually go somewhere and do something different and have an impact, like so many of you have had on my life. After that, I ended up, you know, meeting Cindy Coleman, also in Iowa. She was in University of Iowa, and we became fast friends. And I tell you, if you don't have a friend or two, stay with it. You'll make one. It's one of the best things next to sponsorship that I found. Somebody that I can say the truth to. Somebody I can be myself with, somebody I can be silly with. I can be very silly and it's a lot of fun. And also somebody I can let down my guard a bit with and listen to and share my life with. You know, I have a partner at home. We've been together now about 10 years, but I have family and life partners in this very room that have been with me most of my life. And so I'm so grateful for that. Point being, I guess, rounding down here, the next point, last part of my sharing with you, what has AA done with me? You know, I'm not sure if I explained it really well, but I was not somebody, I've always been somebody that has really, really good intentions. I'm an extremely, naturally very kind person. I root for you. I care for people who are vulnerable. I've had opportunities to work with people who are elderly and stuff like that. It means a lot to me. But as an alcoholic, that's not in recovery. That's not having that one alcoholic working with another. That's not taking some guidance from a sponsor, talking things out when all I want to do is quit and I don't want to show up tonight, and have an encouragement to say, well, I'm going to be there. We'll miss you if you don't show. Why don't you come along and say, okay, that kind of thing. As an untreated alcoholic, whether it's because I'm drinking, because I'm not drinking and I'm not with you, I cannot consistently be that. I cannot consistently be kind and thinking of you. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me that selfishness and self-centered is the root of my problems, and that my ego has to be smashed. And it's really clear on things like that. And the neat thing about it is, like, all the way from back in the very beginning, I'm sure somebody told me this, but this is kind of something that I still do today. And I think it's been really helpful. I thought about in the very beginning, I had no worth, that no idea that I could help anybody else. Certainly not like some of the characters that I've mentioned help people, you know, that's not me, you know? And the thing is, I wanted to be the kind of person that like would write my grandma a card and actually write it out, put a stamp on it and get in the mail. I wanted to be that kind of person. I love my grandma. And so even before I had gone through any steps or anything like that, something got in there, was like, I'm going to do something creative about what kind of sober person I want to be today, in addition to what somebody suggested. And so I would write that card, you know, and I feel a little bit better about myself and that kind of thing. And about 7 years sober or so, I had a big blow up again with my parents. And I went back to my sponsor and I said, I'm done. This is not happening. And she said, my sponsor at that time said, you know, when did you think your amends were about you? Like, why don't you let your parents off the hook of trying to wait for them to want to get to know you? Why don't you get to know them a little bit? You have everything you need. You're absolutely wealthy in Alcoholics Anonymous. Why don't you spend some, a little bit of time getting to know them? And it changed my life. And I started to become like a detective. And I do some of that type of inspector type work in my actual professional life, which is kind of cool. But I became kind of a detective and I got curious about my mom and my dad. And we started on a different journey. And I tell you, nobody was counting on me to be the person that would show up for anybody when it mattered. And yet here we are. I'll tell you what I do. I get up in the morning and I ask God for help. I try to get my head a little bit around the nature of my condition. And that is that of myself, I am really nothing. But with you and with God, I can actually go somewhere and be somebody who I can live with at the end of the day and feel pretty decent about. I call a number of other alcoholics throughout the day, whether it's somebody I sponsor or I talk with my sponsor. I study the material, the literature. I go to a number of meetings and I say yes when I can. I'm a little bit all over the place because I'm tired. It's about 11:30 at night here and I'm usually in bed at about 9, but that's okay. Like, I'm happy. I guess it's civil, like unfiltered. There's been so much going on. This person that I described to you, I've just grown so much through AA and through God's grace and through the encouragement of friends and sponsors and family in AA. And about a month ago, my parents went through that derecho storm in Iowa, and they had a bunch of power damage and stuff. And it really laid bare. I was sharing a little bit in the green room. It really laid bare some severity of my dad's cognitive impairment that he's going through as he's aging, and he doesn't think he has. And gosh, you know, my oldest brother and I, we were able to fly in there, and you know, when it came time to take in my dad to an assisted living facility, I was a point person to help coordinate that and get that going. And he wasn't afraid at all to go with me into the car. He didn't really understand where we were going or what we were doing. My mom was quite ill from exhaustion, and we got her taken care of, one of her friends, later retired doctor and nurse, and with COVID and everything like that, she couldn't go into the hospital. We didn't feel comfortable that way, and I drove my dad over to his room and got him all set up there and left and took care of the house and got the tree damage cleaned up and started paying bills for mom. And my dad called me the other day and we were chatting on the phone, and he doesn't understand where he is or why he's there. And he was in a lot of pain. And part of me thought, you know, I just want to get off the phone with this person. You know, this is hard. And there was no question. I just didn't realize, I was telling Cindy about this. I just prayed in real time. In 5 minutes, right? And there was nowhere else I wanted to be was be there with my dad. And I guess between 7 years and 31 years, my dad and I are real good friends today, as much as he can be with him. And he knows I love him, and I know he loves me. And my mom and I, too. And we sat there, and I knew that he didn't understand when I told him. He said, well, where am I? And he named the place, and he said, well, am I in Virginia? And I said, no, you're in Iowa. And he said, well, but no, I'm in Virginia. And I said, no. And we went back and forth. And the bottom line is I was able to listen to him. And I just sat there and I prayed and I thought, God, I know this. I know my dad doesn't understand me and he's in a lot of pain. And I just want to transmit love to him. I just want him to know that I love him and that God loves him and he's going to be okay. And I just said to him, you know, I was like, Dad, listen, I can hear you're in a lot of pain. And it sounds really uncomfortable, and I'm really sorry you're hurting. And he said, it's just very uncomfortable. You know, we went back and forth, and I guess my point is, I'm getting into some detail here, but, you know, that's really what matters to me. You know, what's my life like today? I'm part of my family. I'm part of my sponsorship family. I'm sharing openly, and I'm letting anybody here know that's not sure about it, that if you come here, if you let yourself get a little help and you let yourself maybe open up just a little bit, then perhaps, like me, you will get to be who you really are everywhere you go all the time. And that's a wonderful thing. So I think I'll wrap it up. Thanks so much.
Commitments available birthdays at this meeting. We define an A birthday as anything that's freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, or anything that would affect you from the neck up. And if you're a regular attender of this meeting, we would like you to celebrate your cake with you. Please email our scribe, Ann P, at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org.
Hi, everybody. I'm Ann, and I'm alcoholic.
Please do this by 6:30. Otherwise, you might have to wait until the following week to get recognized. We have several birthdays tonight. This week, we've gone deep into the till and got a professional singer to sing us happy birthday.
You ready? Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. Day from the peachy. Happy birthday to you.
Keep coming back.
Keep coming back.
All right, our birthdays tonight are with Jonathan Cave, 1 year, sponsored by Eddie D. Melissa S. for 2 years, sponsored by Julie W. Chris McSee for 3 years, sponsored by Jason W. Becky R. for 8 years, sponsored by Duffy N. Colleen G. for 21 years, sponsored by Susie S. Dean B. for 23 years, sponsored by Thomas S. Valerie G. for 28 years, sponsored by Jill B. Peggy B. for 31 years, sponsored by Nancy M. Linda O.B. for 32 years, sponsored by Mary M. Norman L. for 32 years, sponsored by Joe S. Denise A. for 33 years, sponsored by Sharon C. So it was 11 birthdays for a total of 214 years. The average is 19.45. Happy birthday to all of our recipients. We have a custom at this meeting of donating $1 for each candle on the birthday cake. At the end of the year, this is our contribution to AA World Services worldwide. If you want to participate in this custom, please email Betty H. at treasure@pacificgroupla.org. Underneath special announcements,